And welcome back to the Cory Doctorow podcast, coming to you live today from my office in my garage, where there's a city crew chopping up a tree outside, so you get to enjoy the dulcet sound of their enormous chainsaws. So before I get to today's reading, just some updates on where I'm going to be. On the 31st of July, just a couple of days from now, I'm going to Houston. I'm going to be the interlocutor for Hank Green of the Vlog Brothers. He has a new book called An Absolutely Remarkable Thing. It's his debut novel. It comes out in paperback this month. He's only doing two tour stops, both in Texas. If you're in Houston, you can come hear me in conversation with Hank on the 31st of July. Now, if you are going to Burning Man, and if you aren't, why not? No, it's fine. On the Wednesday at 12 p.m., you can catch me interviewing Bunny Huang, the legendary Xbox hacker, who is also EFF's plaintiff in our case to overturn the law that bans breaking DRM, Section 12.1 of the DMCA. I'll be talking with him at 12 p.m. on Wednesday at Liminal Labs. That's my camp, which is at 8:30 in Center Camp, which is a very nice location. And if you're hanging around Center Camp at 3 p.m., I'm going to be on the Center Camp main stage. And then on Friday, I'll be speaking at Palenque Norte, which is part of Camp Soft Landings. And they're at 8:15 in C at 1 p.m. Friday, 1 p.m., 8:15 in C, Palenque Norte, Camp Soft Landings. Now, if you're in Santa Cruz, on the 11th of September, I'll be there with Randall Monroe from XKCD for his new book. And then on the 12th, I'll be in San Francisco for the Pioneer Awards, Electronic Frontier Foundation's annual awards, newly renamed the Barlow Awards. And then I'm heading to Houston to jump aboard the Writing Excuses cruise, and I'll be sailing around the Caribbean, teaching writing with a slate of all-star writers, including this year's Nebula winner, Mary Robinette Cole, and there are still some berths if you want to come along. I go straight from the cruise to Toronto. On the 22nd of September, I am headlining the Intergalactic stage at the Word on the Street Festival in Toronto. On the 23rd of September, Jim Monroe is having me over to the Oakwood Village branch of the Toronto Public Library for a panel called Seeding Utopias and Resisting Dystopias. And then on the 24th, I'll be at the Six Degrees Conference doing a keynote. On the 30th of September, I'm going to be in Newry, Maine for the Maine Library Association, be doing a public event as well as a keynote for the librarians there. So if you're in New England, come along to that. Now, in writing news, I have finished the short story I mentioned in the last couple of podcasts, Affordances. That's for Future Tense. That's a joint project from NPR, the New America Foundation, Arizona State University, and Slate. And Affordances is a critical story about AI and privilege. And I've also just turned in the final edits to a picture book called Posey the Monster Slayer. That's a 2020 title from First Second, part of Macmillan. And it's for little kids, and it's about a little girl called Posey, just like my daughter, who tears apart her super girly toys and turns them into field expedient monster killing weapons and uses them to chase off the monsters that come to her room at night. And while her parents grow ever more frustrated with the racket she's making, it's a very cute, fun little story for the burgeoning monster kid in your household. All right, now on to this week's reading. I'm going to be reading another essay from EFF's Deep Links, part of this series I've been doing on adversarial interoperability and the role that it's historically played in tech and how that role is going away, how we're losing the ability to plug new stuff into the existing stuff that we use as a way of getting more out of it and also freeing ourselves from the bad decisions of the people who made it. And ad blocking is a really good example of one of those pieces of adversarial interoperability that's still around, but that is extremely threatened as of this moment. So the essay is called Ad Blocking, How About Nah? And here we go. Ad blocking. How about nah? For more than a decade, consumer rights groups, including EFF, worked with technologists and companies to try to standardize Do Not Track, a flag that browsers could send to online companies, signaling that their users did not want their browsing activity tracked. Despite long hours and backing from the FTC, foot dragging from the browser vendors, and outright hostility from the big media companies meant that setting Do Not Track in your browser does virtually nothing to protect your privacy. Do Not Track grew out of widespread public concern over invasive behavioral advertising that relied on tracking to target ads. Despite a generation of promises from the ad industry that consumers would welcome more relevant advertising, the consistent result has been that users are freaked out by so-called relevant ads because they understand that relevancy is synonymous with privacy invasion. Nothing is so creepy as ads for a product that you looked into earlier following you from site to site, then from app to app, as you are tracked and retargeted by a desperate vendor's algorithm. Internet users didn't take this situation lying down. They wanted to use the web, but not be tracked, and so they started to install ad blockers. A lot of ad blockers, and more every year. Ad blockers don't just stop users from seeing ad and being tracked, and indeed, some ad blockers actually track users. They can also stop the publishers and marketers who rely on tracking and ad clicks from earning money. Predictably, industry responded with ad blocker blockers, which prevented users from seeing their sites unless they turned off their ad blocker. Now, you'll never guess what happened next. Actually, it's obvious what happened next. Users started to install ad blocker blocker blockers, the biggest boycott in history. The rise and rise of ad blockers and ad blocker blocker blockers is without parallel. 26% of internet users are now blocking ads, and the figure is rising. It's been called the biggest boycott in human history. It's also something we've seen before in the earliest days of the web, when pop-up ads ruled the world wide web, and users went to war against them. In 1994, Hotwired, the defunct online adjunct to Wired magazine, displayed the first banner ad in internet history. 44% of the people who saw that ad clicked on it. At the time, it felt like advertising had taken a great leap, attaining a conversion rate that bested print, TV, direct mail, or display advertising by orders of magnitude. But it turned out that the click rate on that Hotwired ad had more to do with novelty than any enduring persuasive powers of banner ads. Even as web companies were raising millions based on the fabulous performance of early ads, the efficacy of those ads was falling off a cliff, with click-through rates plummeting to low single digits. This created a desperate situation where publishers needed to do something, anything, to goose their click-through rates. Enter the pop-up ad. That's when Ethan Zuckerman, then an employee at Tripod, invented the pop-up ad. He has since apologized. These ads spawned in new windows and were much harder to ignore. For a while. Human beings' response to stimulus tends to regress to the mean. The refrigerator hum gets quieter over time because you adapt to it, not because the decibel level decreases. And so, pop-up ads evolved into ever more virulent forms. Pop-under ads, pop-ups with fake close buttons, pop-up ads that respawned, pop-up ads that ran away from your mouse when you tried to close them. At the height of the pop-up wars, it seemed like there was no end in sight. The future of the web would be one where humans adapted to pop-ups, then pop-ups found new obnoxious ways to command humans' attention, which would wane until pop-ups got even more obnoxious. But that's not how it happened. Instead, browser vendors, starting with Opera, started to ship on-by-default pop-up blockers. What's more, users, who hated pop-up ads, started to choose browsers that block pop-ups, marginalizing holdouts like Microsoft's Internet Explorer until they, too, added pop-up blockers. Chances are, those blockers are in your browser today. But here's a funny thing. If you turn them off, you won't see a million pop-up ads that have been lurking unseen for all these years. Because once pop-up ads became invisible by default to an ever larger swathe of internet users, advertisers stopped demanding that publishers serve pop-up ads. The point of pop-up ads was to get people's attention, but something that is never seen in the first place can't possibly do that. How about nah? The internet is full of take-it-or-leave-it offers, click-through and click-wrap agreements that you can either click I agree on or walk away from. As the online world has grown more concentrated, with more and more power in fewer hands, it's increasingly become difficult for web publishers to resist advertisers' insistence on obnoxious tracking ads. But internet users have never been willing to accept take it or leave it as the last word in technological self-determination. Ad blockers are the new pop-up blockers, a way for users to do what publishers can't or won't do, demand a better deal from advertisers. When you visit a site, the deal on offer is let us and everyone we do business with track you in every way possible, or get lost. And users who install ad blockers push back. An ad blocker is a way of replying to advertisers and publishers with a loud and clear, how about nah? Adversarial interoperability. Adversarial interoperability occurs when someone figures out how to plug a new product or service into an existing product or service against the wishes of the company behind that existing product or service. Ad blocking is one of the most successful examples of adversarial interoperability in modern history, along with third-party printer ink. When you visit a website, the server sends your browser a bunch of material, including the code to fetch and render ads. Ad blockers throw away the ad part and show you the rest, while ad blocker blocker blockers do the same, and then engage in an elaborate technological game of cat and mouse in a bid to fool the server into thinking that you are seeing the ads, while still suppressing them. Browsers have always been playgrounds for adversarial interoperability, from the pop-up wars to the browser wars. Thanks to open standards and a mutual disarmament rule for software patents among browser vendors, it's very hard to use the law to punish toolsmiths who make ad-blocking technologies. Not that that stopped people from attempting it. Adversarial interoperability is often a way for scrappy new upstarts to challenge the established players, like the company that got sued by IBM's printer division for making its own toner cartridges and grew so big that it now owns that printer division. But adversarial interoperability is also a way for the public to assert its rights and push back against unfair practices. Take-it-or-leave-it deals are one thing when the market is competitive and you can shop around for someone with better terms of service. But in highly concentrated markets where everyone has the same rotten deal on offer, adversarial interoperability lets users make a counter-offer. How about nah? But for how long? Concentration in the tech industry, including the vertical integration of browsers, advertising networks, and video content under one corporate umbrella, has compromised the internet's openness. In 2017, the World Wide Web Consortium published its first ever standard that could not be fully implemented without permission from the giant tech and media companies, who have since refused that permission to anyone who rocks the boat. In publishing that standard, the W3C explicitly rejected a proposal to protect adversarial interoperability by extracting legally binding non-aggression promises from the companies that made up the consortium. The standard the W3C published, Encrypted Media Extensions, or EME, for restricting the playback of video, comes with many dangers for would-be adversarial interoperators. Notably, the risk of being sued under Section 1201 of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which bans tampering with access controls on copyrighted works and holds out both criminal and civil liability for toolsmiths who traffic in programs that let you change the rules embodied by EME. One driving force behind the adoption of EME was the ever-tighter integration between major browser vendors like Google, video distributors, and advertising networks. This created a lopsided power dynamic that ultimately ended up in the standardization of a means of undoing the configurable web, where the user is king. EME is the first crack in the wall that protected browsers from those who would thwart adversarial interoperability and take how about nah off the table, leaving us with the kind of take-it-or-leave-it web that the marketing industry has been striving for since the very first pop-up ad. All right, then, that's it. I'll talk to you next week. Hope to see some of you in Houston with Hank Green. Bye.
You've been listening to the Cory Doctorow Podcast, licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-alike US 3.0. Or as Woody Guthrie put it in another context, this song is copyrighted in the US under Seal of Copyright 154085 for a period of 28 years, and anyone caught singing it without our permission will be a mighty good friend of ourn, because we don't give a dern. Publish it, write it, sing it, swing to it, yodel it, we wrote it, that's all we wanted to do. Many thanks to John Taylor Williams for mastering. That's Ryneck Studio, W-R-Y-N-E-C-K Studio, @gmail.com. John Taylor Williams is a full-time, self-employed audio engineer, producer, composer, and sound designer. In his free time, he makes beer, jewelry, odd musical instruments, and furniture. He likes to meditate, to read, and to cook. Talk to you next week.